Okay.
Thank you.
This session of the Independent Oversight Committee for DDD District West is now called to order. The date is November 26, 2024. It is 6:08. I just wanted on the record that we have been debating mathematics, and I say 5 makes a quorum of 9, but Michelle and Larry tell me, according to the Arizona Attorney General, it does not. So we do not have a quorum, but we're going to hold the meeting anyway. We are recording it, transcribing it, so that we can share the transcription with the rest of the members, but it will not be posted to the website, unfortunately. But I think it's important, because there are some very important issues that we need to discuss. We just can't vote on anything. So we can ask the individuals here present questions, but we can't as a body ask DDD questions that they can't ask them questions that we want them to answer. I was going to say that they have to answer, but they never have to answer our questions. We have the right to ask, and if we don't like the answer when we officially ask a question, then we have the right to ask ADOA to make them answer our questions, but we have no right to make ADOA make DDD answer our questions, if that makes sense. So we're a public forum with an open meeting, and hopefully sunshine is the, and I hate to use this word because I don't like the negative connotation, but the quote is that sunshine is the best disinfectant. So our point is to look for accountability and transparency. So hopefully we're not wasting all of your time. Hopefully there is a purpose to our gathering, and we are just not spitting into the wind here. So do we have anyone who has to disclose a conflict of interest? If there is, the committee member needs to disclose why. Any conflict of interest? Jamie, before we go any further, you have no conflict because your group home was not part of that $750,000 settlement that was done by the state of Arizona, mentioned on ABC 15 last week.
Thank you for the clarification.
It wasn't, right?
No, it wasn't. I thought you were stating it. You're correct. No, it was not.
No, I didn't think it was.
No, it was not.
But I need you to put it on the record, even though it's not a record, that it wasn't. So.
Yes, you're correct.
And I'm very glad that you're here, because as an administrator for a group home, as I said in my email to everybody, we're not here to talk about specific cases. We're not here to talk about specific individuals. What we're here to talk about is the improvements that have been put into the oversight since 2018, how they're working, how they're not working, and what we can suggest needs to be added to that oversight. So I'm really glad that my favorite compliance person, quality person, Dolores, with us, because we know that we can always count on Dolores, whether it's the truth that Dolores would like it to be or not, we always know that we get the straight story from Dolores. So I'm glad that you joined us, Dolores, because it's not an easy topic. It's a difficult topic. We know everybody who is at this meeting, and 99% of the individuals employed by DDD and providers, their heart is all in the right place. So we just want that on the record. The point here is not to have a shooting gallery of DDD employees DDD staff or service providers. It's to do our best to try to help the system. So, okay. Now that we've got that conflict of interest part over with, it's now time. I should look at my agenda. It's time to do the introductions. My name is Dee Friedman. I, for now, am the chair until one of you decides that you want the job. It's all yours. We'll be glad to have a vote when we have a forum, when we have a quorum. I'm a retired attorney by trade and currently a professional compliance officer. My son, Andy, was a DDD All-Tex Mercy Care member from the time he was 2 years old in 2003 until his death in 2021. So, Brad, you're next.
I'm Brad Doyle. I have a 38-year-old son that's on the severe end of the spectrum. I've been, my goodness, how long have I been on the committee? I've been on here a long time. I've been advocating for a long time. I'm currently in limbo regarding my job as cafeteria manager, and it sucks because I miss all the MD kids, and I had three VOPE rehab kids that were working for me, but you know, you got to do what you got to do, but that's about what I'm doing, so that's me.
Crystal, you're next on the list, on my list here, as I scroll down.
Yeah, I'm Crystal Fox, and I am with the, I was about ready, like I'm PRC in the PRC meeting. So I'm a psychiatric nurse. I'm a registered nurse. I have a daughter with autism. She is 22 now. And I also do a lot with behavioral health as the Arizona Mad Moms. And I have a little update to share about that, just since we're not a quorum and stuff anyways, but I was one of the 29 speakers at the REMS hearing to get rid of the REMS for clozapine, which has to do with the blood draws at for lifetime. And so this should actually open the door for some of our DDD members that have schizophrenia as well to receive this medicine, because the blood draws hopefully will be not required after all this. That's it.
Okay. Going down my list, Jamie, you're next.
Hi, everyone. My name is Jamie. Jamie Moore. I am adjunct faculty at Grand Canyon University. I teach online, all classes focused on literacy, specifically remediation and interventions with struggling readers. I also am a private tutor. I go home to home and I tutor children with profound dyslexia, and I teach them to read, as well as the associate director for a group home in the West Valley. And I am the guardian to a gentleman that is in a group home in the state of Arizona. He's about 30 years old.
Okay, Pam.
Good evening, everyone. Pam Dewey. I am a registered nurse, retired, yay. I have a grandson who is a DDD All-Tex Mercy Care member. And he's 6 years old now, just had a birthday. We had a lot of fun. My background in nursing was mainly in neurosciences and in clinical research in the most recent years. So.
Okay. And I'm just looking at our agenda items. We don't have anybody from the public who's not invited. So I'm just going to skip down to number E and ask if there's anybody from the public. It's called the public time. This is the time for public comment. Members of the committee may not discuss items that are not specifically identified on the agenda. Comments are limited to 3 minutes per person. So is there anybody that I'm missing here from the public who would like to make a public comment? Please raise your hand. Okay, so we have invited Dr. Loki, and I really appreciate your patience with us, Dr. Loki. You had offered to come in October, and unfortunately, the meeting was canceled because of a lack of quorum. So that's why I didn't want to cancel tonight's meeting, because that would be 2 months in a row. So the first item on the list is member death data, DDD tracking and trending. So the floor is all yours, Dr. Loki, if you would.
Well, good evening, everybody. Nice to see you all. Let me tell you a little bit about myself, so since you haven't met me before. My name is Farah Loki. I have been with the division as the Quality Management Medical Director since February of 23, so almost 2 years now. I come directly from clinical land. I left my clinical medicine job at as a pediatrician, general pediatrician. I've been a pediatrician for about 20 years. And my last job in the 4 years before I joined DDD was at the dreaded PCH as an outpatient physician at their outpatient. But prior to that, I had my own practice for a number of years. And my focus was children who were enrolled in the DDD or had any other considerations like ADHD and things like that. Those are the kids I love to see. But of course, I was a general pediatrician and saw all comers for the children from 0 to 19. So that's a little bit about myself. Before I kind of go into my spiel about how we kind of track mortalities and what we do every day with them, I'm just wanting to know if there's any questions from you guys as to specific what questions you have about it, and we can answer those first, or go ahead, Peter.
Yeah, Dr. Loki, I, as a parent who had a child who was a DDD member who died, who did not have an autopsy done, and I want the record straight. We weren't asking for an autopsy. But there are some members of this committee who are not here present, but are wondering why an autopsy was not offered or an autopsy was not done. Because they feel that our members have conditions that are not being tracked and trended. They're not being recognized because those autopsies aren't being done. From my point of view with my child had a condition called vanishing white matter leukodystrophy, which, as you know, until 2020 was basically worldwide not recognized as a specific condition, although leukodystrophy was beginning in the last decade to be recognized. I'm not sure if it is recognized here in Arizona. So an autopsy would have been useless. But if you could speak to that issue and how, even though we try to change the system, because it's my understanding that basically autopsies are done here when there's a question about criminality, cause of death, when there's an uncertain cause of death, and they wonder if criminal charges may or may not need to be brought, but not necessarily because we don't really have a research hospital that's concentrated on doing autopsies and learning from them. So it's kind of useless to have an autopsy done. It's an expensive procedure. It puts the family through a lot of undue stress. And there's all kinds of cultural questions and all kinds of other questions. So if you could just speak to us as to your opinion. You may not share my opinion, but how, with your tracking and trending and the information that you're gathering, how that autopsy and that information may not be helpful to you. You're the doc, you're the medical doctor, not me. So, but I just want to set that on the table because those issues have been raised by our committee members, if that makes sense to you.
Sure. I'll keep that in mind. And as I go through the process a little bit, I'll talk about that a little bit too. Sorry. So just so you know, every day, our triage team gets all the incidents, of course, as you know, and of the mortalities that come in, they are pulled out of the incident reporting and they are put together and researched, and more information is gathered about the member and where they lived and their diagnoses and so on and so forth. And that information is put together in an email that is sent to the team as well as me. So we look at these, the mortalities every day and look at the information we have to decide whether or not they become, sorry, I don't know what's going on in my throat, a quality of care concern or not. There are some limitations to that. From the information that I get, I have to make that decision in terms of the information I get. And sometimes we have a limitation to some of the information that we get just because of the nature of the fact that we're DDD and we don't always, in any, whether it's DDD or APS or DCS or any other places, we may not get the full picture. So we track those every day. We make our decisions every day and we move forward with quality of care concerns. When we are worried about the manner of death or what could have happened. And if, just so you know, it is our angle, our viewpoint is if there is a DDD personnel that is involved in the death in some way, if they were living in a group home that was paid by DDD, if there was an attendant care or something like that. So that is what the angle that we look at to make sure that there was nothing that involved a DDD employed person that may have been involved in the mortality in any way. In terms of autopsies, as a physician, an autopsy absolutely gives you lots of information, right? So if you do have a mortality where you didn't understand how they died, the manner of death is unusual, the information is very limited, sometimes we get. Sometimes I do wish that I had an autopsy to tell me more about how a person has died. But that's one of our limitations as well, because we don't make that decision to say that this person needs an autopsy. As you said, as a parent, you made that decision. Guardians will make those decisions. And yes, if there's criminality involved, the medical examiner may suggest that an autopsy is done to help prove whatever they think may be going on. So we don't always get that information, but there are some mortalities that we do investigate that sometimes I wish I did have that to give us more of an idea of why the death occurred and what may have been, especially when we cannot pinpoint the real reason, and that can happen sometimes. So, but of course, like you said, there are limitations in terms of how autopsies are viewed in Arizona and how they're viewed by guardians and how they're viewed by the medical examiner themselves and what they feel is necessarily not. And we don't know what goes through their brain as to when they choose not to versus choose to do an autopsy. So we go through that and we are tracking and trending, meaning we are looking and putting what we find, the reason for the death, into buckets, and we're working through going through that and making dashboards and processes for us to see if there are trends in certain places and things like that. And ultimately the goal would be if there's something that comes out that seems to be a death that occurs because of a certain situation, that we can educate and go out there and help people prevent that certain death, that diagnosis or something like that. So prevent that. So that's kind of the process we go through. We look at our mortalities quite frequently. So like I said, we look at them daily. Then I look at them. I'm the one who looks at them ultimately when they finish their investigations on them and make sure that they've gotten what they need in terms of their investigation. And then we look at them again in a committee monthly, where we look and make sure that we did, it's called Mortality Review Committee. We look at them again and make sure we don't need to get any more information, or we feel that there's any changes that need to happen or anything like that. So yes, Angie put the policy in there. So that's overall what we do. Is there any other questions to help me clarify some more for you and go from there?
So I had a person, so they wrote an article about the 22 deaths that happened, I think, 2023 probably. Mm-hmm. So is there there's no real public like acknowledgement of it, like if deaths are preventable, if they're unpreventable, if they're everything says the kind of the same thing, that it's just an untimely death.
So in terms of our process of investigating deaths, as you know, that we have the process of it being opaque to once we go into investigations, it's opaque. And so the outside, like news and public, would not necessarily know what we have found in those investigations. We take it very seriously and we look at each death very closely. And I know one of the questions that came up was the difference between unexpected and expected death. Mm-hmm. So those, unfortunately, I wish they were better terms by access to really, so people, when they see that, they understand what it means more. But expected and unexpected is looking at whether or not, so most deaths are unexpected, of course, because people have an untimely death, as they say, that's an unexpected death. Expected deaths, as access puts, is anything where it was something that you thought was coming. Either they were very ill, they had multiple diagnoses, you know, there was a process of slowly decompensating and moving towards death because of those reasons, or they were put on hospice and they've been on hospice for a long time. We understand that there is something happening there that they may die. Those are things I look at to see, I assess, how long have they been on hospice? What are their diagnoses? What are their ailments to make me say that was an expected death? But most deaths, as you would agree, are unexpected. So when you break that down, some are unexpected and you look at it and you say, yes, it looks like they had these issues. It looks very evident of what happened. And so I wouldn't say that is something worrisome, meaning they did die, they did have a death, but there was nothing that we can see with the information we have that would have made it preventable that we would have to investigate it, versus something that's looks like I need more information, looks like we need to delve into it to understand why suddenly there was a death. And so that's when we delve into it as a quality of care concern. Does that make sense?
Sort of.
Okay. Ask more questions so I can clarify, because I'm trying to.
I'm just so, like, I see a 83-year-old man and uh-huh. he's got a unexpected death. I mean, and he's, you know, in DDD. So I'm thinking, that's kind of the normal age to die. So he probably actually died from, you know, natural causes.
Sure, but it's still unexpected. You didn't know he was going to die that day.
But so it seems like, I don't know, it just seems like there should be something that says, you know, we resolved it. It was, it came up, you know, everybody agrees it was natural causes, the family after the investigation, everything, that it doesn't stay unexpected. Because there's no way really to pull out, when you look at it, there's no way to pull out something that might have been preventable. I mean, even med errors, just different stuff like that. How do we know things aren't a med error? How do we know things?
And that's what we look at. So unexpected, it wouldn't change. For instance, if we say it's unexpected, he may have 83 years old, he may have been fine the one day and then died the next. That was unexpected. We didn't know he was going to die that day. That's not necessarily going to change once we go through our investigation. It was still an unexpected death, but we might have a resolution as to why he died. And like you said, it could be natural causes that we go through everything and we say, no, we didn't find anything untoward happen to him. We didn't see anything wrong with his medications. And therefore, it was a natural death and he passed away at his time that he was going to pass away. But there might be other times where we find when something could have been prevented. If this had been prevented, maybe he would have lived a little bit longer and then had a death when he was supposed to die later on. So the unexpected won't necessarily change depending on the resolution of the investigation.
Okay.
Go ahead. Do you have your hand up? You're mute.
Can you share with us, Dr. Loki, both from your experience as a practicing pediatrician,
sure,
and now as a DDD medical director,
uh-huh,
in the past 20 years, have you seen any significant changes in mortality rates for individuals with IDD? Either, I would assume, life expectancy. Are you seeing any of that?
I wouldn't be able to tell you exactly. Look, I haven't researched that to say that I looked at that.
No, just your experience.
Well, my experience, what I have seen of those who have taken care of over the years with certain diagnoses, we have seen a life expectancy increase for certain diagnoses. I could, you know, trisomy 21 Down syndrome, people with respiratory diseases that they would died earlier and they lived a little bit longer. So I definitely think there is progress being made in helping people live longer who have the diagnoses that we have here in the DDD. But I couldn't tell you exactly how much of a difference it has been without really researching that. So,
but do you know, are those, is obviously the current IR system,
mm-hmm,
is difficult to track data, and hopefully we're going to be moving someday to the Access database system, right, where it will be easier, because I can only assume that one of your strengths is data analysis.
Absolutely.
But are there, have you seen just in the way as a primary care doctor, and you shared with us that you had a significant number of your patients who have IDD over the last decades, have you seen a difference in the way that, and this is not a slam at all, so please do not think it's a slam. 20 years ago, I'm sure you did the best you could with the information available to you. How have you seen clinical practice evolve? And do you think it's because mortality and morbidity has been better tracked and trended? And I would assume you're hoping it's going to be even better tracked and trended in the future. Does that question make sense to you?
Are you asking just with DDD or just in general with the 20 years of work, just seeing patients? I'm not sure if you're asking specifically for DDD.
I'm sure if you knew as a practicing physician whether your patient was a DDD member or just an individual who had an IDD diagnosis. So
I did know who they were DDD members because I was very involved with getting them into the DDD and making sure the DDD knew what services they needed. So I did know that. It's hard to answer that question because when you are a clinician looking into the DDD and when you're into the DDD looking out, there's different kind of information you see. So I definitely think that some of the things I think of every day is I was a physician who was concerned with the IDD population, who was concerned with people with children with disabilities. And that was my focus, my niche. That's what I wanted to make sure I did good in the world with those, with children like that. Not all physicians are there yet. You know, we're still trying our best to educate pediatricians and family practice and physicians to focus on that a little bit more and understand the nuances of having patients with IDD and the nuances of having patients with different disabilities. So I think there's a lot of movement that still has to happen in the medical world, but I think there's a lot more people on board coming in and wanting to be experts in that field, in the field of you know, treating patients with IDD and disabilities. So that I think that's a wonderful thing. And I think that will help overall with the specialists that I know who are very involved, that they're doing everything they can to prolong the lives of people with disabilities of many different sorts. So is that the question you're asking?
Kind of, but the follow-up question to that is, now in your new position, mm-hmm. as a medical director, how do you see, and you don't have to give me concrete answers, but do you see that you have an ability to help drive that trend to improve care for community members?
Yes, absolutely. I think we do have that, especially with data. Like you said, I am a bit of a data junkie. I like the data. I think when I started 2 years ago, one of my main focus was quality data, making sure we use all the data, that all the input we have, to construct it in ways to give us stories, tell stories, and tell and help us move forward with whatever initiatives we wanted to move forward with. So I definitely think we're working towards getting more automated dashboards and things like that to give us that information quickly, and so that we can be able to pick out that one scenario, that one diagnosis, or that one cause of death that seems to come up too much. And maybe we come back again around to it and work on education for our vendors and things like that to look at that more closely.
And just before you answer Pam's question, are you actively participating in presentations for professional development for physicians as a DDD medical director?
So I probably will be doing that more soon. Right now, our medical management medical director, that's her wheelhouse at the moment. So she's the one going out there and educating. So we kind of split our work there. She's been with us a little longer than I have. So she was doing that before I came, but I'm happy to join her whenever she needs me. I recently went to a conference about IDD, about providers giving that care, and was a representative there for that. So I'm willing to get in there anywhere I need to. But right now, Dr. Copeland's got that.
And before I let you go, there's a new Access Medical Director.
Yes.
Whose background looks very impressive.
Yes, it does. Yes, it does. So I don't know her, but yes, it does.
Do you think that you might be successful lobbying her to help Access concentrate more on improving the quality of care for DDD members?
I mean, I can't wait to meet her and talk to her about that. You know, I know that I feel that, you know, in my interactions with the CMO that was there, you know, who was leaving, and that she did have that in mind as well. So I'm hoping that she's moved that forward to her new CMO. I always felt that they were very pro helping us in terms of that. So I feel positive about it for sure.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Hi, excuse me. Backing up a little bit, you were talking about the mortality review committee.
Sure.
And how you get the information and you're tracking and trending it. Have there been any specific trends you've identified in the last 2 years that you could tell us about? Is there anything?
I think some of the trends are emerging still. I mean, for me right now, it's more of anecdotal things that I'm focusing on a little stronger myself, and then working on my team, working on getting me data more for that. So I think there are some emerging things that I hope that we can educate, and we do educate more on. I think some specifically is diabetes education. I think I've heard from some vendors that they would like a little more education on seeing the alarm signs of diabetes and understanding when a person may be decompensating with diabetes. That's something I have noticed that I feel like we need to do a little more education on when you see an alarm sign, when you step in and do something. So that's something I'm looking closer into. And some of the respiratory diseases, I think being able to recognize when a person is respiratorily decompensating, sometimes it's maybe a little too late when there may have been some vital signs that may have been more evident. So that's more education on those things. But again, that's all very emerging data for me since we're just starting to compile that really well. So,
mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you.
Does anybody else have any questions for Dr. Loki? If we can, Dr. Loki, if this committee can help you in any way, please sure. Let us know.
Absolutely.
We're not just here to ask the hard questions. We're here to offer our input and also to try to help improve the system. So
yeah, absolutely. And that's what I want to do too, improve the system for sure. That's why I joined CTD.
Do you mind sticking with us while Delora talks to us about improvements regarding group homes that have been made?
Sure, I'd love to hear from Delora. I don't hear from her enough.
Delora and I have a history. Delora is one of our favorite people because we can always count on Delora, number one, to look out for our members. When Delora says, if a problem that needs my attention comes to your attention, you let me know. Delora takes care of it. So we have a lot of respect and a lot of love for Delora, and we're glad that she left her other job and came back to us.
Thanks. Just a quick introduction. I'm Delora Grunt. I am currently the District West Quality Assurance Supervisor. I was the District West Quality Assurance Manager for a number of years. I stepped aside and went somewhere else. And then, as Dee said, my heart just ached for DDD, and I came back. So I've been with the state for 13 and a half years, I want to say, and 12 of those have been with DDD. So that being said, we are doing some presentations at APAD. I know we've done presentations. We've done presentations with the DTA staff, and we are trying to work with support coordination to present and discuss what is an incident report. Because some people really don't know. I mean, we've had incident reports from things like we found a nail, N-A-I-L, in the driveway. Okay, what happened? We picked it up. Okay, that is really not a reportable incident, but we do want to know when something is affecting our members. So we are trying to do education. As Dr. Loki said, education is the key, communication is the key. So we are trying to work with support coordination. We're trying to work with vendors so that we are able to help in that manner. For the month of October, District West entered 992 incident reports for one district. So we have five districts. Of course, District West is one of the busiest, but between West, Central, and East, it's pretty comparable. And then so far for November, we've entered 749. So we are hoping that some of the presentations are helping, that we're not getting incidents that are not important, because we would love for our staff, our triage staff, all of our staff to be able to have more time to really investigate the incident reports that are important, the things that do affect our members.
Hey, Delora.
Yep.
Just a minute ago, you said that District East, District West, and District Central have about the comparable number of
incident reports
per month.
Correct.
Can we just follow that up to say that District West has number two population?
District East has more population.
It's my understanding, and you correct me if I'm wrong, that we have a greater number of group homes here in the West
that
than
is
the
correct.
Other districts. But yet you're telling me that we're not seeing a greater number of incident reports.
Well, we do have the most D, but it's comparable. Okay. There are days when the other districts have, and sometimes they are the incidents like the nail under the van. So we used to do group incident reports, but we no longer do that. So if we have a vehicle that was parked in the DTA and it was hit by another car, members are all fine, but there were 22 members on that. That's 22 incident reports.
But so, my suspicion, Delora, because we have a greater number of group homes, is that you would see a statistically significant greater number of incidents. And so it's actually a compliment to our staff here in District West that you're not seeing that. And I want that pointed out.
And so our nurses do go into the homes. They do provide education. And I do believe that that makes a huge difference. We have a great communication line with our vendors, both the districts and the clinical staff. And I think that that's really important. When questions are being asked, people are like Johnny on the spot to reach out to get those answers or to go out if need be. So we do a number of in-person visits. And again, that education is extremely important.
Yeah, we ask the tough questions, but I also like to acknowledge when people are doing what they're supposed to do and how you're doing it to improve things. That's all I'm trying to ask.
And I would have to give kudos to the district, non-clinical and clinical staff together, working together to accomplish this task also. You know, we're there and ready to help to do some of that research that they might want to know, well, when did this member move into this group home, or when did this member move out of this group home? And so we are also able to help with that. So I just think that, well, I've always thought that West is best. So it's just me. So yeah, I think communication and education, D, are huge. And I do think that we work well with the clinical staff. We do have meetings. We have monthly meetings with all of the staff for our triage, for our investigations, for our district, for our all of the clinical staff. We get together and we have meetings and we're able to share things. So I think the improvement in communication is where we are seeing some of the non-reportable incidents. But again, we tell everybody, when in doubt, report. I would rather have that report that says there was a nail in the driveway than for you not to report because you don't think it was important. So
in your tracking and trending since 2018, I assume most people are aware of the story that came out, the state of Arizona settled with an individual and her family for $750,000 because she suffered abuse in a group home, which it didn't say where the group home is, but I have a feeling it was not a District West group home, but that's just my personal feeling. And because, you know, we don't get into specifics here because of HIPAA, it doesn't matter. But what kind of improved tracking and trending have you guys been doing since 2018?
If you saw the spreadsheets that we have, you would just shake your head. Dr. Loki's like, yeah. I mean, we have spreadsheets that go A to Z to AA to ZZ to, and we're tracking and trending dates, and we're tracking and trending the how many incidents this specific member has and how many incidents this agency has, and, you know, how many medication errors and all of this to ensure that there's education giving to the contracted providers. So it's a lot.
Are you seeing a decrease in the numbers for medication errors?
I do believe that I am seeing in District West. Some of the medication errors we get are, like we had one the other day, the vitamin D3 pill fell on the floor and we had to throw it away. It's okay. Thank you for reporting it. You know, he got his D3 pill. Those type of med errors are the med errors I would rather see than we gave the member the wrong medications or yeah. So I am seeing a decrease in serious medication errors. And I do have to say, I believe that is because the clinical staff, when they go in the group homes, they look at the medication review lists, they look at the medication, and they are educating right there on the spot. This is what you should be doing. This is sometimes their paper and sometimes their computer. But I do believe that it's catching that right away. Okay, we got this medication error that says they gave member A, member B's clonidine. And member B's on all these other medications that may interact. Somebody's out there right away. So.
And just so that I understand, the nurses, who do they report to? Do they ultimately report the medical staff? Yes. The medical directors?
Well, ultimately, yes.
Okay. So they're not part, they're kind of quasi part of the quality team, is that?
We're all part of the quality management unit. We are all part of the quality management unit. So QA is a leg of QMU. We're all part of it. We use those acronyms so we can distinguish. But again, we work together. So.
Okay, Crystal.
Yeah, since I've got both of you here, again, I'm a psychiatric nurse, so I'm an RN, and I review the behavior plans usually about 4 times a month. I have a question, and maybe you guys can help out. Maybe it's in the behavioral health department or a different doctor, but there's a lot of strange, like ordering multiple antipsychotics, and then there's the behaviors are still for the individual still like meeting obviously behavior plans and multiple interventions. So is there people who in your medical risk management stuff, is there a certain amount, like if they're on over 2 or 3 antipsychotics, does that go up to, is that elevated, or is it like my job to elevate it or PRC's job to elevate it? Does that make sense?
That's a really good question. I don't know. I would have to ask the behavioral health administration team about is anything like that. From our point of view in QA, when we're looking, getting incidents and we look into something and find that there may be some interactions happening with medications and we see behaviors, we see that trending of behaviors happening for the same member over and over again, we do suggest, or we do, you know, we might get together with their SC to just suggest if they've gone to their behavioral health provider, and, you know, suggest maybe that they get looked into by meaning that they maybe have too many medications on board, or if they need a dosing switch or something like that. But from the QA side, we can only kind of give them our, you know, our suggestion, and it really sits on the SC and then going to the Behavioral Health Administration and asking them for help on that aspect. But I think that's a great point. That's personally something I see a lot of, and I, you know, being a pediatrician and having to manage, sometimes I would have patients who came in from their behavioral health providers and I just saw it was too many medications. It was not a well prepared mix of medicines. And one of my biggest pet peeves is trying to minimize how many medications a person is on and what side effects they may be experiencing. So I hear you. I just don't know what we do on our side. I would have to ask Dr. Arnold or Dr. Underwood on our side over here. So.
Okay. Yeah. Because they do, sometimes they list also really odd reasons for being on the medication. I know there's some off-label stuff, but not usually what they're writing sometimes. So, okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. I had a question. Delora, going back to the reports for medication errors, it seems like recently I've been seeing a lot that have to do with medications not being reordered in a timely fashion or picked up from the pharmacy. And, you know, when it's the anti-seizure medications and things like that. And I don't know, is something like that trended or how... I get it. I have a hard time keeping up with my own sometimes, but it just seems like that.
A great percentage of those, Pam, are the guardian reorders the medications, and the guardian has either chosen not to. Now, I'm not saying all of them, but a good percentage of those, they are. And so we try to work with support coordination on those to ensure that they're doing it.
So even if they're group home, the guardian gets the meds and got it.
But if it is the staff, that is where the medical team steps in and makes recommendations. And yep.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Are we using the insurance information regarding payment for medications for individuals? Are we doing post-review auditing to flag when individuals are on multiple psychiatric or psychotropic medications? Are we doing any of that yet with algorithms?
So I know the CMO data team does some work on gathering information about how many of our members are on certain antipsychotics. That's part of the utilization management that has to be done in a managed care organization. With our two subcontracted health plans, we would expect that they are also doing that, and they're following antipsychotic medications, length of time, dose, how much it's dosed, you know, are they getting it monthly or more than monthly? Is there, you know, some kind of something like that happening? So they should be tracking that. I wouldn't be able to tell you exactly if they could come back to me quickly and say that they're going to come back and say, you know, these members are getting too many of something, but they should be tracking that and watching that.
Is it possible for them to actually report that data to you on a regular basis so you can track and trend it?
That's a good question. I'd have to ask about that. I'm not totally sure about that. Just, you know, some of the questions you're asking, as you know, we're kind of we have two lines here, right? I'm quality management medical director, and then we've got a medical management medical director in our CMO. So some of these questions are medical management questions that I can always come back with the answer for, but I don't have firsthand experience of what's happening over there. So.
Yeah, no, I'm not. Please don't take offense with anything.
Absolutely not. Just letting you know, I'm trying my best, but I can always come back with the answer from the medical management team if you need.
Yeah, I just, you know, I mean, I know that their algorithms are better than yours because their computer systems are better and more sophisticated than DDD's. And so I'm just wondering, if when we have a quorum, it would be helpful for you that we make that kind of suggestion to DDD, because DDD keeps telling us, has been telling us, they are the MCO and Mercy Care and United are their subcontractors. So because DDD controls the check, there's things that they can ask for. And I'm not insinuating that either United or Mercy Care is not sharing data with you. I think it's never been asked for. So, you know, let's try to see how we can work all together and get you and the clinical management side as much data to track and trend that will be helpful to you. I don't want to flood you with data if it's going to be meaningless. But right. if we can help to make those suggestions, we're more than happy to do that. We just don't know unless you educate us, and then we'll be happy to ask for that for you. So,
as the check that you called it, we do audits on Mercy Care and United Healthcare, just like Access does audits on us. That may be something that's part of the audit. I know it's nothing that I would be part of. I don't know that Dr. Loki would be part of those audits.
Yeah, I mean, Dolores, right. We do audits of them, but the medical management team would do audits on something like that. We would have to ask. On the quality side, we look at just the quality components of the two subcontracted health plans.
Yeah, I mean, overall quality, both plans are great. So, I mean, obviously, I have my personal preference, because if I stated many times, my husband works for Dignity Health at St. Joe's and has for the past 22 plus years. So we have an automatic bias in our house, but I love Dawn and the people at United also. So we're not complaining that anybody's doing a poor job. And obviously they both use the same providers, because it's a limited number of providers available out there. They belong to both provider networks, but anything that we can do to help encourage improvement in quality of care, let us know. That's what we're here for. Hey, Crystal, this was your topic. Is there anything that you want to talk about regarding this topic that we haven't covered?
No, not really. I got kind of the answers that I was expecting. Again, I was actually responding. I know the person who wrote that article. So I was responding to her. I told her I'd bring it up in the oversight committee to see if I could get any better answers about those 22 deaths. If, you know, all 22 were, you know, resolved without any, you know, basic, you know, 10 of them were med errors kind of a thing. Again, it's the person who wrote the article, of course, thinks the worst, you know, that DDD is up to something. So I just thought I'd try to get an answer. I personally, being a nurse and knowing DDD and knowing how many of our kids and loved ones that we buried in DDD because of their disabilities, even my daughter, Tia, I mean, she's on borrowed time. She had a brain tumor. So I know that they don't live as long as you would expect. It's just hard when you see, you know, to see if anything is a, you know, happens more than once or happens a lot or it's not natural causes. So
can you, Dolores, can you just, and I'm not putting you on the spot, so if you don't have the answer and you're not comfortable saying, then don't say it. But can you just tell us from your standpoint, as the District West quality manager, you're not seeing, nothing is out at you with those 22 deaths. They're not that different than what's happening in the other four districts, and they're not that different from the trends that you're seeing nationwide. We're in the bell curve, I guess, is what I'm asking you to confirm for us. Yeah, only if you can.
Well, I can only say I learned a long time ago to swim in my lane. My lane is not medical. So.
But even with abuse and neglect.
I think you're right. I think we're in the bell curve. I don't, you know, I think that the investigations that are being done are good quality investigations. And I think that if there is an issue, those are being uncovered and taken care of.
I guess I do have one more question. So if somebody died by suicide, would that be listed separately somewhere? Would that be in an incident report? Dee, would you see that? Like if somebody took their own life and like actually completed suicide? Would that be?
When I see the reports, and we can have those reports sent to you if you'd like, Crystal. Michelle can put you on the list with Cynthia and I. I've never seen one differentiated out for suicide, so I don't know.
We do bucket it out. So that is one of the buckets that we use with our data analysis. We do have suicide, homicide, accident, trauma accident separated out.
But does that come to on the incident report that way? Or because I know when I read like the jail records, uh-huh. I mean, the jail basically has everything is, you know, died at the hospital, died here, died there. But then they do have the one thing that's separated out, which was self-inflicted.
So, you know, an incident, it may come in and say that they knew for sure that person committed suicide and it'll list it like that. But there are also some deaths that come in that you're not completely sure what happened. And then that may come out later on that it was deemed suicide, whether it's through autopsy, whether it's through investigation. So it has to be pretty obvious for us to write to have suicide immediately if it's on the IR, but sometimes it's not always, you know, outright said. So like a homicide would be, or an accident would be, right? So.
But do we see those separate? Do you see those separate? Like if like somebody does say get hit by a car, would it say trauma?
I can ask for that additional information. The information that I get is pretty cursory. And so when I get the information, what I do is I look at the date of birth, I look at the date of death, and then there's an explanation on the bottom. There's like a little note section that doesn't follow a pattern, but it's some notes that are in there. So then if I have a question, I can always ask for additional information. And so far I haven't, because there isn't anything in there that's tripped a trigger for me, if that makes sense. And the other problem with me asking about specific individuals, is if they're doing an investigation on the individual and it's questionable, the cause of death is questionable, then I can say right now DDD is going to put it into whatever their version of peer review is. And it's going to be very difficult because of HIPAA for me to get specific information on specific individuals. So basically what I use those reports for is to informally track and trend if I think that there's a problem that we should be asking questions about. Then I'll come back and I'll ask Michelle to get me more information. And I know she's going to get it from Delora for me, so I know I'll get the straight story if Delora can give it to me. But, you know, we're talking, not only are we talking HIPAA, we're talking potential lawsuits.
Yeah.
So,
you know, my response often is I am not able to respond to an open investigation.
Yeah. And then so last question. And no, I don't need the papers. I trust you guys. They're just again. So is there a like a checkbox if they're in PRC, like if they do have a behavior plan, or like if they are SMI, or if there's on the behavioral end of it? Do you ever see that, D, if on your incident, if they're part of?
I'm not getting those specifics, Crystal, okay. But I've never asked for them either.
Are you talking about on the incident reports?
Yeah.
Is that Crystal? I mean, it usually it'll spell out if they, during the investigation, if they request a copy of it as part of the investigation.
Oh, part of the behavior.
Okay. Yeah. I've seen that on numerous ones. So that, you tend to believe there is one then if they're requesting a copy, yep, of it. So, yes.
Yeah. Anytime they have behavior medications, they almost always have a behavior plan.
Well, they're required to.
Yeah.
If they're on specific behavior medications, they're required to have a behavior plan.
Yeah.
Is there a, Dr. Loki, again, I know that this isn't your sandbox specifically, and I'm not asking you to play in anybody else's, but is it a possibility that every med list on a behavior plan could potentially be reviewed by DDD staff when it goes to PRC?
I believe that is part of the process of the planning team of the PRC. The planning team is made up of the SC and members of the PRC and the planning team. So the SC would look at some of those basic elements that would be listed on the PCSP, which would be the med list. And then it goes through the planning team as well. And there are people, experts on the PRC that are behavioral people would be able to look at it. So that is one of the things that is looked at when all the information is being gathered for behavioral plan.
And are you aware, just, and again, I'm not trying to put you on the spot, and I understand that's not your sandbox, but are you aware of the egregious errors and inconsistencies in the med reports on that go to PRC? There are 3 separate med reports,
mm-hmm.
and I've heard estimates, I don't do PRC, but I've heard estimates of up to 90% of more where there are errors between the 3. It's not the same med list in the 3 different spots.
Mm-hmm.
So you can't, if you're telling me that your medical staff, somebody from your medical staff, and I'm counting the nurses as part of your medical staff, is actually looking at those, then I'm appalled.
So my nurses aren't looking at them because they're quality. They're not looking at that. But there should be on the planning team someone who is verifying the medication list. However, there are some barriers to that, and that would be the medication, it'd be getting the medication list from the guardian or from the vendor, if that's accurate or not, if there's enough communication between those 2 people to get that information. There are some barriers there. There is a big, we're making an effort to align our BPs and our PCSP documents. We're working on a lot of process improvement there as well, but we're only as good as the information we can gather. And if that information is not good, then our information won't be good. So it's kind of starting from the guardian or vendor up that makes sure everybody is in line, you know.
And if those med changes are not being reported,
correct,
the guardian's getting the med change at a med review and is not even reporting that to the sport coordinator until they have a review. Oh yeah, right. 3 months ago he started on this. Okay, well, they don't know that.
Right.
And before we go to Crystal's question, I just want to note, I'm on a lot of parent support groups on Facebook, and I noticed parents are asking why the support coordinator has to have a PCSP meeting after a hospitalization. So somehow that must be either something is finally being implemented that should have been implemented before, or it's a new policy. I'm just wondering what it's going to take to meeting after the hospitalization to actually getting the support coordinator to be a part of the discharge planning meeting before the person leaves the hospital.
So there is a great effort to make sure that is being a consistent process of discharge planning with the support coordinator on board. You know, I've been on many of those discharge planning meetings that have been very good with everybody important that needs to be there involved. There is a big effort to make sure that there's that PCSP meeting after a discharge to align those medications, to make sure we understand what new follow-up is needed, those kind of things. So that's absolutely a focus right now in DDD and medical management and all that stuff.
Crystal.
Yeah, I was just going to add that when you guys try to do the medication list, or when they try to coordinate the three things, it would be helpful if there was, it was typed, or if it was printed out. That's the one suggestion I've had, because the when you read the doctor's handwriting, it's, you know how that goes. And then the poor, you know, BHTs or not BHTs, but the, you know, group home people are trying to copy what the doctor's writing. And then the same with the case manager. Again, if they don't have any nursing experience, or they're trying to spell these words, and if it was computerized and printed from the, you know, like Jewish Family Medical Center, you know, some of them that are still writing them out.
That floors me, Crystal, because, you know, there's such a push for electronic medical prescription. You know, I've been doing electronic prescriptions for years and years now. And I find it funny that we still have to deal with doctor's handwriting with medical prescriptions because of such a push of being accurate, more accurate, you know. So I just want to say my handwriting is really nice. You could always read my prescriptions. So, but yeah, that's interesting that you say that. I would not have thought that was still a problem. So,
yeah. And again, we're paying, you know, DDD is paying them. They should be able to type it. They shouldn't be writing it. I'm sorry. My daughter's all of a sudden becoming needy. So anyway, coming out and mooning everybody and everything. So, I don't know, maybe DDD can make that a goal in next year or the year after or something to force them to.
I'll definitely pass that on to the PRC people, the BHK people, so they know that we're dealing with written out medications.
Yes, there you go.
We have finally gotten it where we no longer accept handwritten IRs.
Right.
Finally. So that's good. Because talk about, you have something that's three pages of writing and you're trying to read that and type it. So baby steps.
Before we get off this topic, Jamie, as a group home administrator, is there anything you want to add to the discussion that we haven't covered, or are you comfortable ending the discussion here?
Hi, Dee. Thanks for asking. Yeah, there is something that I'd like to add. You know, we pay somebody that does BTPs, that writes the BTPs professionally. And when she does that, she goes through the medication list, she gets the MAR, and then checks to make sure. And there's been many times where she's had to make calls to support coordinators to say, you know, I don't have a match here on the PCSP. Can you tell me what's going on? So that has been very helpful for us. However, I know that all vendors do not use somebody that professionally writes BTPs because their price can be a little bit high. And some vendors are, you know, they can be trained to write the BTP on their own. But that's been very, very helpful for us. And then occasionally she'll raise a question because she has so much experience with BTP. She's able to inform us of things that might be a yellow light that is in the BTP that's very, very helpful, or a red light that's if it's been brought up at a meeting. So that's all I wanted to say, is that we hire a professional and that's been most helpful for us so that there's no errors.
It's also very helpful if the team is helping to write that BTP, which should include the support coordinator and guardian, if guardian is, and if the team is helping to write that, it should be written better and more accurate.
Yeah. Well, Dee's right. It's the medications are almost never right. So either the dose is wrong or the timing's wrong, or again, it gets complicated because sometimes it says one pill or two pills and that doesn't get transcribed correctly. Nurses go to school for a long time to learn how to transcribe medications. And so when I'm on there, I'm able to help them match it all up. But I really and truly, the treatment plan coordinators, the behavioral health techs, or the you know, the assistants in the homes, and the it's just a really, it's almost impossible. They really need it printed out for them. You know what I'm saying? They really need it. Just it should be electronic. It should be printed. It should be copied, so that it's just exact. And then it would be exact from all three, and everybody would just have that exact. That's the only way you're going to get them to match. Because you're asking people who aren't nurses or doctors to do something that takes a lot of training to get it right.
A
lot of the medications are similar, and I've even had them put down the whole wrong medicine, or a dose of a medicine that would kill somebody, you know, add a zero at the end instead of just two, it'd be 20 milligrams, you know. It's really, really tough to ask people who aren't trained to do that to match those medicines, even though, like Dee says, it should be. And I think electronically is the only way you're gonna see that really be successful. It's probably over 90% where the meds aren't right, even with the treatment plan person. So go ahead. That's it.
Jamie. You're on mute. Oh, you put your hand down.
Can you hear me now?
Yeah.
Okay. Sorry about that. I think I put my hand down instead of unmuting myself. So I just wanted to chime in from my personal experience with the MAR and the medications. And Crystal's right. It's really a beast to tackle when you don't have that education. And it's also a very tedious process. And, you know, one of the things we've come across, one of our biggest barriers is the MAR that we receive from the pharmacy. And I think that if somebody doesn't have enough experience, or if they're not trained with medication, they could just go through a MAR and start typing up all the medication. However, if they don't keep a close eye on it, or if there's not somebody overseeing everything, we often have discontinued meds on our MAR that the pharmacy refuses to take off until they get a DC from the doctor. And we can make multiple calls as many times as we want and say, okay, well, this member went to the doctor, verbally said to DC it. And the pharmacy tells us, that's nice. We need a DC written from the doctor. So then we go back to the doctor, request a DC. The DC doesn't get sent in. So we do mark it out on our MAR, but I could just see that there's a lot of problems with that in itself. I just recently dealt with over 15 medications, spent 2 hours on the phone with the doctor's office getting medications that needed to be taken off, where we had already called three times. So we got 12 of them taken off. There's still three that are not taken off. So I think in the mix of everything, it just becomes such a convoluted mess, especially if the person is not ready to sit down and, one, do a tedious task, two, there's nobody overseeing them, and three, if they're not very familiar with what's going on with the members. So what I mean by that is it could be that people are writing BTPs that are at an administrative level, but don't really have their hands in. They're not really working with the member, so they don't know what is DC'd and what is really going on, if that makes sense, which can make a huge difference when you're turning in a document, because you really don't know what that person is on. You're just typing stuff up.
I'm wondering, with electronic health records, all access members, and I may be getting this wrong, so please correct me, all access members are part of HEDIS, is that correct? The state electronic medical system. Is there any way that can be harnessed so that these errors can be cleared up?
So the issue with the HIE, the Health Information Exchange, is not all providers participate in it, and also guardians and members can opt out of having their information listed in the HIE as well. Wouldn't it be great if we had one national health EHR, which was the original intent, but didn't happen? Because that would reduce those jumps that Jamie was saying. You're going from what the doctor is writing to the pharmacist, to the vendor, to the, or the guardian, to VDD, to the planning team, to the PRC. You're having all these jumps, and more jumps you have, the more variability in a process, the more risk for mistakes, right? So so that the HIE is there, it's very helpful for us sometimes with investigations when we need to gather information from hospitals, but not everything is on there. So, you know, if I could have a magic wand, I would have allowed years ago in 2009 when we were setting up EHRs to have one national EHR that everybody used. So
yeah, maybe there's a way, as the person who pays the bill, AKA access, obviously it's above your level, but I don't understand why access can't require that all access members use HIE and that all access registered providers use HIE. Otherwise you don't get paid. So we don't have a quorum here. So, you know, we can't put together a motion, but maybe that's something we ought to think about recommending for the future to improve it, because I understand privacy as an attorney, but I also understand the fact that we want quality care, and I understand HIPAA, and everybody involved is required to follow HIPAA. So that shouldn't be a problem. But does anybody else have anything else on this subject? Otherwise, we'll move on. Michelle, you want to? Don?
Am I able to chime in here, Dee?
Of course you are. You're okay. Always invited to join in our meetings. You just unfortunately can't vote. We can't count you for quorum because your employer won't allow you to join. Officially join.
I know. No, I just am hearing about the medication confusion, and I'm hearing a lot of conversation with regard to guardians and so forth. And, you know, that's what OIFA is about, is providing education to our family members and guardians and so forth. And so I know that's not the whole answer, but as Mercy Care and OIFA and Christina here, I think we're going to go ahead and I'm going to initiate a meeting between the three of us. And we all go out and have, you know, forums and resource fairs and things like that. And I think that could be something that the OIFA Alliance can work on to create maybe a one pager on, you know, kind of the key points for guardians. And I know that DDD, I know Leah and Christina have created, I don't think they call them one pagers, Christina, I don't remember the name of what they are, but.
Quick reference guides.
Thank you. You guys have all of those quick reference guides and we can print them and things like that. But I think, you know, sitting here on the IOCs, there's not always an opportunity for me to hear an avenue where I can help support. And I know often we feel, you know, like we're answering the tough questions, but I think that's something that I'd like to do. And as OIFA, and then, you know, maybe have a report out. And I would push it out because our forums are every month or every 60 to 90 days. So maybe mid next 2025, we can kind of have a report and just double back of how many families and guardians we were able to help support and give this type of information to. So everybody knows I'm a mom of a 38-year-old young lady who has unique and special challenges, and an aunt to an individual who is a wheelchair user through a severe cerebral palsy diagnosis. And so all of us here in OIFA have lived experience, Dr. Loki, just so you're aware, of, I don't know if you know the health plan OIFAs, but we're very active on this call, all of us. And so I just feel like it's important. It's something that maybe we can help in some way, Dee. So I'm going to start working, but like I said, we wouldn't expect any type of report out until next year. And I know Christina and Wendy are just loving me for talking about that. But it's, we have a part in this, you know, and we all, you know, I listen to them educate families as well. So it's really important for me.
Well, I think I can tell you, Dawn, I don't know of a medical director from a health plan or from DDD who would not be willing to help you and who would support that effort 100%. Starting with Dr. Loki, because they all see the value of, like she said, one electronic health record system, especially for DDD members. So thank you very much. And if we can help you, let us know. So before we close up this topic, anybody else? Hey, Michelle, you ready for the holiday drive?
Sure. So I emailed the committee, all committee members for all of our DDD IOC volunteers, the information, the form for DDD's holiday gifts from the heart program. That program is starting to round up their donations for the members of DDD that have indicated their members and their families that were in need of assistance for the holiday. And that's anything from, you know, food to gifts. It was my understanding that some of our committee members like to donate gift cards so that they can be used for purchasing items, either gifts or food items for members for the holidays, so they would have something. I have reached out to the volunteer coordinator's manager or supervisor, because we don't have a coordinator currently, and they've been providing me with information on how to get those gift cards if you wish to contribute to this this cause to our members and our family members of our members. I've been met with limited information currently. Basically, what it comes down to, and I'm going to get that message in front of me right now. Okay.
Michelle, do I get to whine the loss of Richard Couts at this point in time?
Sure.
It was a lot easier last year.
Great person, and did wonders with DDD and volunteering and prior to that with the Independent Oversight Committee, as well as being a support. But go ahead, what were you gonna say about Richard?
No, that's my whine. Richard's not here, and that's why this is so difficult.
Yeah, when I reached out to Whitney and asked her about the program, she stated that here it is. She said that they would coordinate with the person donating to get the gifts, the cards to the families in need. When I reached out to Michaela, Mickey Barnhart, who was the previous volunteer coordinator who assisted with this program last year and has her hands in it a little bit this year, even though she's in a new position. She said the gift cards can be of any amount to anywhere, grocery store, Amazon, Walmart, Target, and they need to come with a receipt from purchase, and that they would also assist with coordinating how to get those cards to the members. Right now, specifically, I know in the past, Dee, you had stated you got cards and you put those gift cards in an envelope, took them to a DDD office for them to be in our office mailed to Richard.
Mm-hmm.
Currently, I do not have a contact of that type. I'm looking for a name and a person. However, I have extended, and I do extend myself, is meeting with a contact point on District West. And I'd be happy to meet with you to pick those up if you have cards to donate and make sure that they get to who they need to go to.
Thank you.
And that's not a problem. Yeah. I know you spoke about, you know, meeting different members on different occasions. And I don't have a problem with that at all.
Okay. So if anybody would like to participate, if you get a hold of Michelle, she can make arrangements and she'll make sure that the cards get to where they need to go. So
yes.
Again, I miss Richard.
We do too.
Okay. We really can't discuss changing our monthly meeting day. Well, we can discuss it, but we can't vote on it. Does anybody have any issue with moving it to the third Tuesday instead of the fourth Tuesday? Because we conflict with Thanksgiving and Christmas being the fourth Tuesday. So that's 2 out of 9 meetings that are compromised. Crystal?
I don't have a problem with it.
And everybody likes 6 o'clock, Jamie?
I like 6 better than 5:30.
Yeah, 6 is better for me.
And the third Tuesday wouldn't be a problem?
No problem.
Pam?
It's fine.
Okay. So, but we can't.
I can't do it.
Can I do it, Michelle? Do I have like some sort of holiday emergency authority for December? Can I call a special meeting?
Well, what I could do is I could assist you by sending an email out and letting them know this is the intent, collecting feedback from everybody and arranging it in that manner. There is time, and there's plenty of time to do that if that's what you'd like to do.
I can call an emergency meeting, right, Larry?
You can call a meeting anytime you'd like.
Okay, I'm calling a meeting for the third Tuesday of December, so then we avoid the Christmas issue, right?
What's that date? Anybody know?
Sure, just a second here.
December 17th.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, Dee, you can. I wasn't ignoring you. I couldn't find my
it's okay, Larry.
My mouse.
Yeah, because I'm not.
I actually won't be here on December 17th.
Well, we're not going to be here on the, well, my family's going to be eating 7 fishes on the 24th. I don't know what everybody else is going to be doing on December 24th, but we're Italians, so we'll be eating fish.
I'll be at Legoland. That's the only reason why I'm going with Kaylee and the babies.
Okay, how about the 17th?
That's the one I'm going, the 17th.
That's the one.
Yeah.
So do we want to move it to the 10th?
I will be here on the 10th.
What does everybody else think about the 10th? Jamie?
I can do the 10th or the 17th, whatever works for everybody.
Pam?
Yeah, 10th is fine.
All right, we're doing it on the 10th then, Michelle. I'm calling the special meeting. We're doing it on the 10th, and we're just not going to meet on the 24th because we won't have quorum, I could tell you right now.
Right. Okay.
So next on our list, does anybody want to discuss or review any policy issues? Hmm. Okay, next on our list is staff updates, and then after that is Larry's update. He's going to yell at me because he doesn't have a copy of the annual report done yet, but it's on my list, Larry. I will get it to you. So let's go to staff updates first. Michelle, take it away, please.
Sure. Christina.
Yeah.
Would you happen to have an update for us?
I do have a few things to share. So I believe that I shared at we didn't have a meeting last month. I believe that I shared at one of our previous meetings that the division is working to develop a 5-year strategic plan that is going to be completed and published by July of next year. It's been nearly a decade since the division has published a long-term strategic plan, and leadership really feels like the time is right to revisit the division's mission and goals for the individuals that we support. So Michelle and Morgan are going to be working with Thelia Morris, who is our project management office administrator, to join a meeting in early 2025 to present on the strategic plan and also get input from all of you on this committee as well. Last month, we held our second annual Self-Care for the Caregiver Conference in both Tucson and Phoenix. This was the first year that we held the conference in Tucson. And we were happy to report that it was attended by over 200 people. The Phoenix conference had over 230 attendees. And of those over 400 attendees, 99% of the conference surveys indicated a rating of 4 or 5 out of 5. So people felt like it was incredibly worth their time. They were connecting with other caregivers, getting lots of resources. And it was a great time for everybody that was there. If I do say so myself. And then the final thing I have to report on is that, you know, I've chatted a little bit about the positive behavior support training project that we have been working on. Some of the newest numbers are showing that we have trained over 11,300 direct support professionals from 160 qualified vendor agencies. We do have 622 trainers from vendor agencies across the state who are able to go on to train other direct support professionals. And we've had over 100 individuals, family and caregivers, trained by Raising Special Kids. PBS is continuing to occur, or the PBS training is continuing to occur biweekly as part of the DDD's regular state ops curriculum for new and current employees for those members who are living in any of our state operated facilities. So I think that's all I've got. Does anybody have any questions?
Yes.
Yes.
Unfortunately, your boss is not here. We have no idea if we're going to be able to say goodbye to her in December. But I do want you to know, for the District West IOC, you are now the point woman.
Well, I'm here for.
We're not going to have Leah to go to anymore. You are not getting CC'd anymore. You are getting directly contacted, Christina.
Perfect. I'm ready for it. So I hope I don't let you all down. I've got this, guys.
You haven't so far.
Perfect. Perfect. Well, got an amazing team supporting me, so I'm very grateful. So. Anybody else? Perfect. Well, have a happy Thanksgiving, everyone, if you celebrate.
Thank you, Christina. Delora, I know that you provided a lot of information earlier, and you're standing in for Diane this evening, and we really appreciate you being here. Do you have an update that was prepared for tonight?
Nope. I've already presented what I had prepared.
Okay.
But thank you for asking.
Well, thank you. Thank you for the information and the participation this evening. Is there anyone else with DDD that wanted to provide an update that I may have missed? Okay. So, Dee, it's just your...
It's Larry, then the health plans.
Mm-hmm.
Well, good evening, everybody. I have no updates from ADOA. Thank you for your comment on the annual report. I'll be on the lookout for it. And is there any questions or that I can try to answer for the group?
I appreciate your patience, Larry.
Well, of course.
Okay, so who wants to go first? You want to go first, Dawn?
Sure. One thing that I've been promoting for the last year is Caroline Chu on our team. She's our family and child liaison and an awesome person. But she has been training families to become credentialed family support specialists. These individuals, the point is for employment. But I'm hoping that this IOC will take into consideration when you're working with families or assisting families, making them aware that United Healthcare's OIFA offers this training if they're looking to move into some of the behavioral health realm, even if it's like a part-time, you know, venture. This is really important because most of our members also touch behavioral health in some ways. So please keep this in mind for us. Caroline has so far trained 5 agencies and their staff to support families. And I'd like to see more families who have loved ones who, you know, have unique challenges become educated and step into both, you know, worlds and, you know, really benefit from this training. It goes over all of the system navigation of behavioral health that goes through, you know, our whole process. So really important stuff. Please reach out to me. I'll put my email, my direct email in the chat. Actually, I'm going to put Caroline's because she's the one that's over this project. But feel free to reach out to her. She's lovely and can give you more information. And it's free. At United Healthcare, we don't charge for this training at all. Thanks. Are there any questions or?
I actually spent August 22nd, which was wonderful for me, with people going through that training, and it's a great training. So thank you for doing that, Dawn. In any way we can help you, just let us know. We'll try to get the word out.
Oh my gosh, Dee, they loved you. And listening to the stories and answering the questions. So just keep in mind, this is a really, this is a big need amongst our families. So yeah, spread the word if you can. Thanks.
So I don't know if Frederica or Wendy wants to go next.
Wendy does, because I want to say that I was the valedictorian of that class that Caroline did. And it's a great, with all seriousness, it was a terrific class, and I am now a credentialed family support partner, and it really was a wonderful, wonderful course. So I do encourage people to take it. I want to share, and I'm happy to send the flyer to Michelle to distribute to the group, the UConn Access and UConn are partnering to help improve our state's behavioral health system. Yes, I am reading this, by the way. Our partners, we've partnered together to do some 90-minute Zoom calls with different groups of families across the state to understand how we can improve the behavioral health system here in Arizona. Holy buckets, I think there's 20 different groups that are coming together from all over the state, and then specifically to if families receive high needs case management, if they have a, that's one group. For there's a group for CRS, there's a group for DDD, etc., etc. And there's a $50 gift card that will be given to those that participate. The groups are small, 12 people or less. And it goes over about 6 different questions. And I think it'll be a terrific opportunity to folks, for folks to have their voices heard toward changes that we can make in the system. So as said, Michelle, I'll send you that card. People may be getting it sent to them in different ways through different avenues, but I wanted to share that opportunity tonight with you all. And again, I'll have Michelle send that out.
Thank you. Frederica says that she doesn't have any updates. She put it in the chat. Does anybody have any questions for her?
Christina, do you have anything you want to add to the UConn? Yeah.
I don't. I just got that email too, and I have not had a chance to process it fully, but I think Michelle, if we get her the information to send out to the groups, will be really helpful. But yeah, yeah, like you were saying, they're looking for information or little, basically mini focus groups for people who have, you know, children who have been adopted, a focus group for children who are currently in DCS care, focus group for people who are with CRS. I think there's, yeah, I think there's a folk, if you can think of a focus group, it's probably on there. So
for sure. Awesome. I'll send that right now. Does anybody have any questions for Mercy Care?
All right. Just keep doing what you're doing. And just to remind anybody who's invited to our meetings, you're always welcome to participate in our discussions. You just can't vote on our motions. So we're pretty informal. Just jump right in. And you're here because you have expertise and we've invited you. We want you here. So please jump in anytime. Next thing on our list is discussion, review, possible action on committee membership. We don't have a quorum, so why don't we wait until we have a quorum before we have any discussion on membership, because the individual will have to reintroduce themselves unless there's anything anybody wants to say. And then the next thing is discussion and review of incident reports and behavior plans. Is there anything anybody wants to discuss?
No, I think we talked about quite a bit with behavior plans.
We did the public comment. Consideration, discussion, and possible action. There's really no reason for us to go into executive session. It's time for us to adjourn at 7:56, 11:26, 2024. Pam?
One question. Michelle, one of the attachments was a volunteer timesheet. Attached to the email? Is that something we're supposed to be doing, or what? Can you tell me what was that for?
So if you choose to use it, we'd love to know the time that it takes to be a DDD IOC volunteer. That way we're able to share that information with other volunteers coming in to be able to give them real data on what it looks like. And I know it's individual for each person that's on the committee as to, you know, you give what you can. But if you're interested in helping us document that so that we can provide that feedback to others, that would be very helpful.
Okay. I don't recall seeing it before.
Oh, okay. Yeah. It's
been there, but I opened all my attachments. I'm like, where? Okay.
Yeah. I send that along with the data and the agenda. And then each meeting for the agenda, there's an opportunity for any member to have a conflict with a topic being discussed. And that's why that conflict of interest form is also included when I send the agenda out. I did want to let the committee know that Pam and I had a little discussion about the shared drive. She's been actively going through that. And so I've changed the process a little bit. So that it makes it easier for her. She is, I am loading the closed incident reports in the folders instead of sending them to archive. And she's, I believe, Pam, that's working out well for you. And I'm sharing the comments she's sending and questions from the, to the district quality team with the committee as well. If anybody ever needs any assistance with getting access to that share drive or any retraining, let me know. We are regularly holding trainings for new IOC members or anybody that needs a refresher on whatever meets your schedule.
And let me just say, I can absolutely not keep up with you guys. So there you go.
Yeah, and just let me know when you want stuff moved out. That's not a problem at all.
Just
okay,
Pam. Uh-huh. You need to go back to your quality training, and rather than trying to read every incident report, do a sampling, because it's impossible for you to read every report. So if you're doing spot checking and random auditing, I mean, that's basically all we can hope to do.
Well, and what I found too is, I mean, there's several new ones, open ones that I have questions on. I just jot myself a little note to come back to it and look at it when it's closed to see if those questions have been answered before I ask additional questions. So, and I don't know, it seems like it's, and it's probably based on the volume, but a lot of them are remaining open for quite some time before they get resolved, it looks like. I know that at one time you mentioned the goal was around 30 days, but I'm sure it's volume based that it seems to be taking a little bit longer.
Well, I'm hoping once we move to the Access database that it's going to be a lot easier to track and trend how long those things are open. You know how tough it is to actually track and trend a PDF.
Absolutely. Which is,
I don't know if you were here to hear my wonderful rant about basically all this new system is just an improved microfiche reader. So for those who are as old as I am and know what a microfiche reader is, so it really is impossible to track and trend. You've actually got to read every incident report. And that's why the metadata is so helpful.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
So is there anything else? We are meeting December 10th, which is 2 weeks from now, 6 o'clock, and that'll be our December meeting. And hopefully we'll have a quorum and we can decide what we're gonna do for January. Thank you very much for your patience. Happy Thanksgiving to everybody. Enjoy your whatever, if you don't celebrate Thanksgiving, whatever you may celebrate, but please enjoy Thursday. If you eat turkey, enjoy your turkey. If it's not turkey, whatever it is, just hopefully everybody spends a day thinking about how they're thankful for what they have in their life. And I just want you to know, all of you to know, how appreciative I am that you give us 2 hours out of your month for this meeting. And I want you to know, even though it wasn't recorded, hopefully we were a little cattle prod or a catalyst, and we're helping to improve the system for DDD members, because this is a very thankless job. I thank all of you, and I'm thankful for all of you. So it's 8:02 on the 26th of November, 2024. We're out of here. See you in a couple weeks. Bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.